It's the greatest of pleasures to talk with Studs Terkel at any time, but particularly to talk with him now because he has just come out with the book. This is your how manyth book, Studs?
Oh, I lost track. Well, 13 or so. Remember, one of the books, Giants of Jazz,
right,
was written 10 years before the oral history,
right,
so-called series began.
Right.
In 1957, but the series known as oral histories, for want of a better phrase, began 1965.
Right, right, 40 years ago. But
yeah,
it's an especial pleasure to talk with you today about this book because as a kind of bookend to Giants of Jazz from 50 years ago, this is a book about the Studs that many of us here in Chicago, at least, know and love the best. We love all the Studses, but this is Studs the ears. This is Studs the ears for music. Jazz musicians talk about people that they bring into their bands because so-and-so, he's got big ears. And this is, you've always had big ears for people, but some people who don't know of your Chicago and WFMT radio work don't know about the big ears for music. And it's extremely exciting for me to relive interviews either that I had the opportunity to hear you do on the radio or to rebroadcast, and also then to go back to some of your earlier interviews, particularly with some of the opera singers that whose names are not even as known as they might be. Rosa Raisa.
I interviewed her a couple of times. Rosa Raisa was the diva of the opera company during its glory days before the Great Depression of the 30s. And she came out of Bialystok. She was a little Jewish girl who came out of this town on the border of, but they discovered her voice. First she'd hear organ grinders, and then she'd run out into the woods, and they'd sing something, Rosa. Her name was Rosa Burstein. And so Campanini, the great impresario, said, that's not going to do for an opera singer. What does Raisa mean? It means rose. That's what I'll call you, Rose Rose, Rosa Raisa. And she's the one, of course, her Casta Diva from Norma is about as great as any, Callas or no Callas. But she is known as the one who created the role of Turandot. Puccini wrote that for her, and he died before it
had its
finished
premiere,
it.
Right.
And Toscanini is conducting the premiere performance. This is after the death of Puccini, and someone finished it not quite as good. And so what happened, and Raisa tells that story so movingly, she was singing Turandot, and it's sung until the moment Puccini died. And that's when Toscanini laid down his baton, addressed the audience, said, and here the maestro died, and he walked out. And she remembered that moment of silence. But think of a dramatic, tragic moment. It was finished, but not the same. But this is Raisa, who had all sorts of memories.
But one of the things that you bring out in the interview with Raisa, not only this wonderful character that she was and these memories that she had, and of course that she started off in Bialystok and she wound up in Chicago and was still, I think, giving music lessons in the Fine Arts Building in the years after her career. But you conclude the interview. I'm wondering if you might be able to read for us the last paragraph. You conclude the interview with Raisa talking about that sense of responsibility. I'm wondering if you might read that last paragraph there.
By the way, one of her great moments was singing with Caruso a number of times, and we'll talk about him in a moment. Here's Raisa saying, there must be that sense of responsibility. My first Norma, my first Aida with Caruso. The next day, even after a triumph, next morning, I would still go back to the piano and would say, oh, I can improve that. I can make it better. I can use pianissimo here or forte there. What artist nowadays does it? After the performance, they take the plane and fly to Alaska. Next it'll be to go and sing to the moon, and she laughs. And with Raisa is a very funny and wonderful soprano. Edith Mason right. also was a diva here, and she's known for her, Madame Butterfly, Un bel di vedremo, is her beautiful aria. And though she sings so delicately, so wonderful, her speech was that of street talk and rough and talk. She was Irish, and she was very heavy, and she's very funny. But she and Raisa both speak of Caruso with love and affection, because he would always offer them a little drink before, because he was nervous. Says, "You are nervous, Signor Caruso." Raisa, the young girl, says to the greatest singer of all time, "I'm a nervous. I'm always very nervous. Have a little, Rosa. Have a little."
Rosa Raiza, Chicago's own, in Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma, a recording made in 1920. Rosa Raiza is one of the many voices featured in Studs Terkel's new book, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Resuming now the conversation with Studs. There's a common theme that you're pointing to, and that is the truly great artist, whether that artist is in blues, folk, gospel, jazz, classical, opera, knows that he or she can always do something better.
Oh, when you're hitting the key, the Billie Holiday. John Hammond is in it. John Hammond is the great impresario of jazz. And Billie always had doubts about her ability. She always had doubts about her own skills. Always. As a matter of fact, he first heard her as the 17-year-old girl. He came to hear a better established singer at the time. Way back, John Hammond, a young aristocrat whose whole life became jazz. He says he heard this girl sing, and every time she sang that same song, there was always a difference. She had an interpretation for that. It might have been a trifle, a pop trifle, or an old blues, but somehow she had this capacity to fit that very moment. The idea, I suppose, improvisation is the key to it. But this doubt, self-doubt, was the key to all. Madame Laura Lehmann, the great leader singer of our century, perhaps, certainly female leader singer, there being Fischer Dieskau. But she was known, and that to me was one of the most moving parts of the book, how it ends, her farewell. She had a following that thought she was everything. They'd worship her. And once a year at town hall, they'd gather. But before that, the opera for which he was best known was the Rosenkavalier of Strauss. And the Rosenkavalier has the Marschallin. She does this role. And she's a beautiful woman. But back in those days, 35 or so was considered old. She has a young lover. He's the Rosenkavalier. By the way, she played that too in the early days, Oscar. And so she looks in the mirror. This is Madame Laura Lehmann describing the scene, a key scene. She looks in the mirror and sees what may be a wrinkle, intimation. That moment she knew she has to give up her young lover to his young love. And so that's the background. This wise woman, she says. So now she's singing this concert at town hall, and at the end she announces suddenly to the audience, "You've just heard my last concert. I will no longer sing in public." And you hear the audience, and you hear the crowd, "No!" She says, "Yes, let me tell you why. I know I've reached the point where from now on I'll not be as good as I was before. You don't know, but I do. Certain songs, one of Hugo Wolf perhaps, a tough one, I may not sing. I know. You know where I learned it from? The Marschallin, that wise woman who knew when to give up her love." And so there's a case of art teaching life, art replicating life.
Was
Da geht der hin, from the first act of Richard Strauss and Hugo von Hofmannsthal's Der Rosenkavalier, Lotte Lehmann, in a recording from 1933 with the Vienna Philharmonic. The interviews that Studs Terkel made with Lotte Lehmann over the years form the postlude to his book, and they all sang Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Resuming the conversation now with Studs on 98.7 WFMT. There's another aspect to that type of a person, and that is replication, because Lehmann then decides to stop, and she goes to California, and she sets up her school. And who is her protege? Marilyn Horn. And who of the artists of today was most like Lehmann in that at the top of her career, everything's still great. She says, I've reached the point, and now it's time I step back, and I teach full-time now. And there's that idea of passing on the baton.
Continuity.
Continuity.
Absolutely. And yet that whole matter, of course there's a life ahead of me, and that's when I met her. She was teaching these master classes in voice at the Northwestern School of Music for a number of years. And then she was doing her own memoir. And there's a lot of work to be done. But my art, my skill, for which I'm best known, is something I know I will stop now. And knowing when to do that, because I don't know when to do that.
Fortunately, you haven't had to stop.
I don't know. I think there's a growing senility here and there.
Oh, no.
But in any event, it's a... I found the book a very moving one to me.
To you, right.
Yeah, found it very, because, you know, the other books called oral histories, for want of a better term, dealt with ordinary, I hate to use that word ordinary people because it has a patronizing air to it, but people non-celebrated.
Right.
Whereas this is my disc jockey days that you know well, because I know you and your parents have been listeners to my stuff for a long time. So this is closer to my, I still call myself a disc jockey. But when I was playing this music, it was a program called the Wax Museum.
That was your first program before WFMT.
Yeah, it was a pun because music was made of wax before CDs, of course, before cassettes. I don't know how to put on a CD. I don't know, and I goop up on machinery anyway. But it was a glory period for me. And I still used, even on FMT, of course, used music sometimes during an interview.
Sure.
I was interviewing Gary Wills on one of his lesser-known books, but it should be known. It was called Under God, Religion in America. Mm-hmm. It was a powerful book, and one of it deals with the Scopes trial, the monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, when Darrow was the lawyer for the young teacher was teaching evolution and thus violated Tennessee ordinance. But William Jennings Bryan, that was a tragedy. William Jennings Bryan was a populist and was anti-corporation, anti-war, but he was a fundamentalist, though. And so he was destroyed, and he died a couple of weeks later. But there was a song, and I found the song before I was interviewing Gary Wills on the book, that was the trial as well, this book, Under God. A song called Bryan, 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 written by the most popular of all country composers ever. His name was Dalhart, Vernon Dalhart, who wrote the Prisoner song, Lindbergh song, Amelia Earhart song. He wrote one called Bryan, Bryan, Bryan. It was a song sung by fundamentalists. And so I slipped that in, this old scratchy thing in the interview. So I do that on occasion.
And one of the other things that you do throughout your disc jockey period with music is you remind us that music shows the best in ourselves, but music can also criticize. I think of the Americana, for lack of a better word, programs that you've done over the years, where you might play a marvelous song by William Byrd or Billings or something from the Pilgrim period, and then you might follow that with Buffy St. Marie or somebody who takes that same period and looks at it from a critical point of view. Or look at Big Bill Brunzi, who can sing a marvelously celebratory blues, and then he can sing, if you're white, you're all right, if you're brown, stick around, but as you's black, get back.
Yeah, of course, the double edge. The double edge is always there. In fact, songs he interpreted. That leads to a question that was asked some time ago about, can a white person sing the blues?
Mm-hmm.
And Josh White, who's a smooth singer, says, no, it can't be. You have to experience it. Well, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
It depends upon the nature of the ache, nature of the hurt, nature of the longing, nature of the dream.
It's so interesting to recall that Josh White, who was thought of and whom we would think of today as one of the most universal of singers, would have regarded, perhaps because of the time, the upbringing, and the struggles he faced, would have regarded the music as limited. I think of another FMT classic of Josh White, One Meatball. But when he sings that song, that man could be any man, and he could be a woman, too.
As a matter of fact, One Meatball was first sung by a little white comic named Jimmy Savo, S-A-V-O, a little clown figure. And he used to sing. That was his song.
Sure, sure. So
Meatball. It was a Depression song.
Yeah,
what can you get for a nickel? He wanted coffee. No, just one. Could I have a cup of coffee? No, one meatball.
And then he wants a piece of bread. You gets no bread with
no,
one meatball.
No, you gets no bread but no with one meatball.
But what about somebody who did perhaps try to put his foot on both sides of the music color line? And you mentioned John Hammond and jazz, but John Hammond also looked into other worlds. And another fellow he found you interview in the book, Bob Dylan. Interview him in 1963.
Well, there's young Bob Dylan, 22 years old. I remember the opening greeting. He was there with the skipper's hat on, a kid from Hibbing. It's been a year or
Hibbing,
two.
Hibbing, Minnesota, yeah.
He's been a year or two in New York. This may have been one of his early radio interviews. And I think, where'd you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? Cotton Eye Joe was a song that Burl Ives was singing at the time of the Renaissance of folk music. But basically, that dealt with one song that hit me at that time. He was 22. Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that song, when my wife was saying, she was thrown by one line in that song. The executioner's face is always well hidden. Well, that, of course, is fantastic. You do think of the executioner with a mask over the face, whether it be the one who chops the head off or pulls the... But he's always hidden. Nobody wants to be that. And then so I think Hard Rain's Gonna Fall deals with atomic rain.
Mm-hmm.
No, he meant rain generally, as though he were prophetic, and that man will destroy himself. And if ever there were a contemporary song, it is now. And he was 22 when he wrote that. But it was interesting. big thing got me there because he was paying his tribute to Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. See, it's hardly done these days to associate continuity. He loved Woody. Yeah. And it's Woody who first got him interested. And he wrote a song to Woody. Now, he sang several songs on the program. One was Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and others. But he didn't want to sing Woody. He sings that only to Woody.
Mm-hmm. If you'll gather round me, children, a story I will tell. Pretty boy, Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee. It was Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon, as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language, and his wife, she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed the log chain, and the deputy grabbed his gun, and in the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. There's a many a starving farmers, the same old story told, how this outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little home. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There come a whole carload of groceries with a letter that did say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Now it's through this world I ramble. I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, some with a fountain pen. But it's through your life you travel, and it's through your life you roam. You won't never see an outlaw to drive a family from their home.
Woody Guthrie, dear friend and colleague of Studs Terkel for many, many years, a tribute by Studs to Woody Guthrie included in his new book of interviews, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. We heard him there in a recording from the 1940s, his own Pretty Boy Floyd. Now back to our conversation with Studs.
Then it's the whole story of Pete Seeger's own family. We know of Pete as the one who gets audiences to sing, as one who is controversial. But we don't know of the family heritage musically that goes
composition,
back.
Composition, musicology.
Hundreds of years.
Collection.
His great-great-great-something uncle was the mayor of New York, you know.
And you bring all of this together,
yeah.
the continuity, a kind of perfectionism, and I don't like that word, but let's say a questing more,
yeah.
that marks the artist.
By the way, you said not quite perfectionism. Leonard Bernstein used that very phrase. He says,
oh, yeah?
Nothing, the attempt to make something perfect.
Right.
By tape or something, isn't it? Some of the greatest works have a little mistake in it.
Mm-hmm.
He says because it's daring.
Yeah.
You don't look for perfection in Mozart about as close to as you can come. You look, now, you can't, he'd also talk about that certain composers cannot be fooled around with. You could have all the fun you want with John Cage or Stockhausen, and the audience won't know the difference. He's not putting them down, merely saying that's it. But with Mozart, oh no, Joseph Cripps said that.
Right.
Cripps, who reestablished Salzburg, the Mozart Festival.
After the war.
I'll never forget his Viennese tone, slightly cracked. It is, you know, the Viennese voice.
Yes.
He says, Beethoven was a heavenly figure. He was heavenly.
Right.
But Mozart came to us from heaven. He was 32, 33, died no one knows where. But you can't fool around with Mozart. The audience will know. And the thing about Mozart that was so incredible is that he hardly rewrote. You know, I think he wrote the overture to Don Giovanni, O Maggio Figaro, on the eve before the
performance of the
you
premiere.
You know who he was like? He's crazy. Fats Waller.
No, absolutely.
So I think of Mozart and Fats Waller.
The people
and
who
Woody
just
Guthrie.
There was a faucet almost.
It could come out.
Yeah.
And you don't rewrite. So with Woody, and to some extent, I suppose, Dylan. But certainly Woody and Fats Waller and Mozart. That's a combination.
There's a combination. That's a very Turkellian. Exactly. I want to just, as we wrap up this conversation, and I hope that there's so much in this book, particularly since we have now your archives of these programs at the Chicago Historical Society, available to anybody, by the way, at studsturkel.org on the Internet. Anybody except Studs, because Studs doesn't know how to use the Internet.
Well, there's still a lot of work to be done on that.
Right, but the point is you can get many of these programs. Yeah. But I want to bring in somebody sort of from just after the book and somebody from just before the book as a way of wrapping this up. Because what you're saying about Bernstein, I'm thinking about somebody very much with us now who people don't realize had a lot of connections with Bernstein. That would be a good topic for a discussion down the line. But Daniel Barenboim, he's actually a bit suspicious of recording. Bernstein, of course, was great live and great on tape and great on television. But Barenboim, for him, music is now. Music happens. And if you start getting, in his mind, too worried about recording it and retaking it and so on, you lose that Mozartian spontaneity.
Okay. I wish I'd interviewed, I goofed on that. I wish I'd interviewed Barenboim, because he also is a very gallant figure. He worked together with Edward Said,
right,
the Palestinian scholar. Barenboim, Israeli in beginnings. And they worked together, and they're working on a piece of music, I think, or a book that would have been phenomenal.
Well, they have one book out, and then they have this orchestra still lives as their legacy of young Arab and Israeli musicians.
So that's one of my regrets.
Well,
not having done Barenboim.
There's still time. But I do have a regret question, not so much a regret as timing, because the one person not in this book, those of us who have known you and known your programs over the years, we often think of people who love opera as having a particular hero or a particular diva. And I associate you with Claudia Muzio.
Oh, wow.
But, of course, that would have been before you were doing these interviews,
right? No, but
right?
I once did hear her.
Yes, but you heard her. I know that.
She came to the high school.
Right.
I was at the father of my best friend then. It was a banker. It was trouble anyway. But he was a lover of opera. He knew Muzio. And she came one afternoon to sing folk songs.
To which high school?
McKinley High
School. McKinley on the west side.
But the big thing is Muzio's letter from Germaine, the father of her lover, who apologizing
in
as
Traviata,
she's dying.
In Traviata.
She reads that letter. My God, she was Dusa. Eleonora Dusan. I know that Calas was great. Now, nobody touched Muzio's. I play that again and again because she was she reads that letter and it's signed, you know, so-and-so Germaine, Giorgio Germaine.
Right.
But she says it in Italian and you know what it says. It's apologizing to this great soul who's dying because she was a courtesan, and she gave up her lover because her father-in-law insisted he would destroy the family's reputation.
Right.
And now he begs her forgiveness, and she reads that letter. Oh, man. It was the way I imagine Eleonora Duse would do it.
I know then that that's how you would have begun an interview if you'd had one with Muzio, talking about
that.
But where do you think it might have gone after that? What else would you perhaps have wanted to have her talk about?
Well, on stage, George Bernard Shaw was a young drama critic. He spoke of the two great singers of the generation, the two great actresses of the generation, Eleonora Duse, the Italian, and Sarah Bernhardt, the French. He said, "I prefer the Italian. She used no makeup." And the queen of makeup, of course, was Bernhardt. She could be a 17-year-old. Duse appearing on that stage, just walking on. Suddenly there's a presence there, and there's a scene he describes. It was not a good play, but she's accused of infidelity by her husband. And the little boy, 3 years old, is there. And that son is not mine. And then what does she do? An ordinary actor would say, "I swear he is," and she'd cross herself. What Duse did, she grabbed that little kid, held it in front of her, and crossed the kid. Think of that scene. She grabs that 3-year-old kid, kneels behind him, and crosses the kid. "I swear." Well, that's only someone like me. She was an ordinary-looking woman. Tragedy is she was in love with this little bald-headed fascist, Gabriel D'Annunzio, for some reason or other. But Muzio, I think that scene with that kid is what you talk about. Or how she'd go up playing a younger woman. She wouldn't do anything. The point is something called presence. Mm-hmm. I saw that an American actress, people run over. Her name was Pauline Lord. Mm-hmm. And Ruth Gordon admired her. I got Ruth Gordon's earlier book, admired her very much, I saw Pauline Lord, and they knew what they wanted. My brother took me. I was 13. And all she did, they knew what they wanted, became Most Happy Fella, the opera, Frank Lesser music.
Right.
And this old Italian vine grower wants a wife, and he sends her the picture of his ranch hand, who, of course, cuckolds him. But she appears, this waitress, answers the ad. All she does is walk on, and I'm 13 years old. She had no makeup, no nothing. And I see, and she's right next to me, it seems, and it was Pauline Lord. See, that's the kind of stuff that gets me.
And what gets us, year after year, book after book, I realize, Studs, that your program, The Wax Museum, began exactly 60 years ago, September 1945. Here we are, August 2005. So for 60 years on the radio and before that on the stage and now with these books, the very things that you're talking about with these people, these are the things that ring the bell with you. Presence, a kind of purity. A pressing on, they're all P words today, a goal towards perfectionism, but a suspicion about the idea that anything can be perfected. It's a questing, and that questing you find, you carry on, and you bring out in these marvelous interviews in the book, and they all sang Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, and I know that you wear the title Disc Jockey with pride. And we're proud to know you here at WFMT.
Andrew, thank you very much. I know you followed me from way back.
Since the womb. The
show. Thank you very much.
Teneste la promessa, la disperazione. Fida ebbe luogo, il barone fu ferito, però migliora. Alfredo in strano suolo, il vostro sacrificio io stesso gli ho svelato, egli a voi tornerà, quel suo perdono, io pur verrò. Curatevi, mercate un avvenir migliore. Giorgio Germont, è tardi.
Studs' favorite diva, Claudia Muzio, in the letter scene leading up to Addio del Passato from Verdi's La Traviata, a recording made in 1935 with orchestra. Pete Seeger, excerpts from the Goofing Off Suite of 1955, reissued on the Smithsonian Folkways label.
Thank you. Jesus bleibt meine Freude. Er ist meines Herzens Trost und Saft.
Pete Seeger, excerpts from the Goofing Off Suite of 1955, reissued on the Smithsonian Folkways label. Critical Thinking is the program. I'm your host and producer, Andrew Patner. Our guest today, Studs Terkel. The conversation with Studs was recorded by Eric Arunas, and the program was post-produced by Jan Weller. Thanks to both of these colleagues. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this and other programs in this series. Drop us a line at rentap@aol.com. That's Patner spelled backwards, rentap@aol.com. Critical Thinking is brought to you by a generous grant from AlphaWood Foundation, with additional support from Richard and Barbara Franke, Richard and Mary Gray, the Joyce Foundation, Scott and Judy McHugh, and the Black Dog Fund, and also from Bill and Jan Gentis. This is Andrew Patner saying, see you next week.